Welcome to the podcast. This is a special edition podcast. My name is Daniel Messner and I'm from Stimmen der Kulturwissenschaften. And this edition is together with Talking Anthropology and Thomas Lohninger.
Hello everyone, also welcome to listeners of Talking Anthropology. We produced this show together for the special occasion of our guest, Carmel Weismann. And you will hear this podcast in our two programs because, yeah, we share the same guest today. And we also moderate it together. And, yeah, I hope this experiment goes well. Because we never did something like this before. But good. Can we just give the introduction?
Yes, maybe we should introduce our guest. It's Carmel Weismann. She's research fellow in the Department of Communications at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem.
You came here just for the two talks you gave?
I won a scholarship. I don't remember. I don't know if I could say the name of the guy because the German names are really hard. Alfred Ehrenbau or something. Mm-hmm. And he used to be the rector here. And I won a scholarship for a cooperation between our universities.
And you gave a talk yesterday at the Department of Theater, Film and Media Studies where... We will talk about at the end maybe, but our main subject is the talk you're about to give at the Department of Cultural and Social Anthropology, my department, which will be about trolling. Maybe we start with a definition of trolling, flaming, and the phenomena you looked in.
Actually, it's very interesting that you said it will be about trolling, because one of the things I was thinking and I will talk about is that there used to be very... fine and separate definitions for various forms of harassment and hate speech. And then recently, I think in recent years, it seems that every form of online violence is called trolling. Everyone are trolls. Everything you do is trolling. So it's not the original definition of a troll. I would call what trolls, the real trolls actually do, the people that we call trolls, cyberbullying, because they're bullies. They're online bullies, and the things they do qualify for the definition of bullying, actually. But probably we like the word trolls because it sounds like they're monsters, Nordic monsters lurking for us online. But initially, the word troll didn't come from this monster. It came from the English word trolling, like trolley, you know, like the suitcases. And it comes from trolling a boat. To the like when you take a boat, when a boat arrives to the deck, then you troll it.
Okay.
And there's also something in fishing that you troll when you fish. So it comes from this kind of thing.
Pulling something to the land from the sea.
Exactly. So this is the idea. The initial idea of trolling comes from this because people who used to be the first generation, let's call them, of trolls, they would try to troll the conversation. This is the way they would disrupt the discussion. They would try to initiate a flaming event or to get people to talk like, you know, like we call it, we have this expression like full gas or neutral. Like, you know, getting the talk to be... Like everybody's talking and wasting their time and energy and trying to convince one another, but then the discussion goes nowhere. This is what they liked. Like you're like in a car, full gas, but you're in neutral. It's not driving. So this is the idea of trolling, and this is the initial idea of those people who actually weren't, they were very polite, this first generation of trolls, because they used to, they would never just flame or say something hateful. They will just plant a small bait, like in fishing, you know? People don't know that they are trolls. They think they are sincere. There is a discussion about something, and then they come and say something like, I don't know what there's so much, why are you so much understanding towards these people? I mean, look at them. They come and they take our homes and they do, I don't know. I mean, you people are too polite. And they say something like this that is sounds sincere, but is provocative, because they know that in this specific discussion, in this specific forum, with this specific people, everyone would jump at it. So this is the bait. If you take the bait, you got caught by a troll. But most people actually, when they know those people, that they usually do that, somebody will come up and say, be careful, don't answer to this guy, don't feed the troll, be careful. He always plants baits like this, just ignore him. And then the flame doesn't succeed, and then he has to move to a different forum. This is the first generation.
And when did this first generation start?
Well, the first research about trolling was by Suzanne Herring in 2002. So it was almost a decade ago on the web.
And so we're not speaking about the really early days with Usenet and mailboxes. It was more like the beginning of the WWW web.
That is the research. I'm sure that there were trolls on Usenet as well.
Yeah, I'm sure.
But the research started only in the beginning of the 2000s.
And also this saying, don't feed the trolls, is really that old. Maybe we now start with your motivation. Why did you start looking at this subject?
Well, I'm an anthropologist by method, but by theory, I'm a sociolinguist of the net. So I'm interested in phenomena that have to do with language and discourse online. And what I figure out is that everything has to do with language and discourse online, because the words and the discourse patterns are your body online. You have no other representation. So everything you do, if it's performing identity, if it's constituting relationship with someone, everything you do is language. And you have to look at it through linguistic tools and discourse tools. So I wrote a book back home, which was recently published, about the Hebrew language online. And it actually sums up a lot of phenomena that happen not only on the Hebrew web, but the way I put it is to see what happens to language between speech and writing, what happens with language and identity, how do we constitute, perform identity through language. And third part is language and relationships. And there I actually had two chapters. One of them was about hate speech, and the other was about other forms of harassment. And this is the talk I'm giving today actually takes both chapters and rolls them into one framework. And I wrote about everything that was written so far about these things. It's not much, but very interesting observations. I've given it some form of framework and found more patterns, and it's just interesting to me how we can hurt each other without seeing each other. It's a philosophical question even, you know? So I'm trying to decipher what are those patterns that hurt us from afar. You know, what do you have to do in order for someone to be abusive when it's just words and he's not near you?
So did you have experience with trolls?
I didn't bump into someone in particular that haunted me, thank God. But I did have a blog, and I did have hate speech commentators on my blog, and people that I was really surprised that someone, a complete anonymous stranger, would say such ugly things to a blogger he doesn't know just because of a post. I was thinking, what is it with these people, you know? Do they actually mean me, or do they just need catharsis right now at home? And it's interesting how to hate from afar. And I wondered if they had seen me face to face or hear me talk face to face, would they act the same? Would they feel the same? I got interested by that, but I didn't have someone in particular haunting me. I do have friends online from the Hebrew web who are really, one of my friends is a troll queen. She's an expert, like the troll slayer, like like the vampire slayer. She's an expert to dealing with trolls in the Hebrew web.
Maybe let's go into your ethnographic research. Which methods did you use? Did you only look at the discourse, or you also met with people and had interviews with them? What was the research focused about?
Well, ethnography is an overall thing for me. It's both online and offline, and I usually do what is necessary to know the environment to depth. So I played it by ear in a way. I didn't plan at the beginning what methods will I use exactly. I was first just online. I opened the blog myself in order for it to be a participant ethnography, and I was getting myself acquainted with the environment. I was commenting in other people's blogs, and they came to comment in mine. And I had a research blog, actually. I called it Dr. Blog. It was funny because this blog was threefold. It was also a text. It was my field notes. I was writing my observations, but it was field notes with an audience. People would come and comment and offer their own observations. It was also my avatar in the field. This is how I was represented to people. You know, this was my online identity. And it was also my house in the tribe, if you could call this community a tribe. Like, this was where I lived, where people would come to my living room and talk to me. So my doctorate thesis, my dissertation ended up being three parts. The blog used as a space, as a, like a place to live or a wall or as a space. And the blog used as an avatar that people would design it the way they would dress up. And they express certain styles through blogs, and they make small communities through the way the blogs look. You know, like the freaks would have black blogs and things like that, and with gothic iconography, and it was really an avatar. And of course, the blog as a text. It was really threefold, and then I had to, in order to understand all of this, it wasn't enough to be in the blogosphere. When I saw that bloggers meet outside, I went to bloggers' meetings. And I interviewed around 25 girls, because I ended up doing the ethnography only on girls. They were more interesting.
And you only looked at blogs, or also at Facebook or Twitter? Or
at the time I was doing my dissertation, it was an ethnography of the blogosphere, because there were only blogs. It was in 2004. Later, I was when I wrote the book, I was looking at Facebook, Twitter, everything, just to see the linguistic change, and all the things I found in my dissertation to be applicable to blogs just happened on Facebook as well. It just took different form. For example, blog buttons are now Facebook groups, and they really have the same function of announcing identity. And instead of copying a button, you just join a certain group. They almost had the same names like the blog buttons, at least the Hebrew web. So it was interesting to see that what I found didn't disappear with the genre. It's the same patterns just going to the next application.
When I listened to this, I got the impression that you use many words that you would usually use for spaces or for rooms and for, I don't know, real discussion actually taking place away from keyboard. So what particular was the findings you had, and also those you will present at the lecture here in Vienna?
Yeah, I think you're right. It's a simple point, but a huge point. The fact that every web page is we treat it both like a page, a published page, like media, and a space, like a place we go to, we meet people, it constitutes a community, it's our blog, our Facebook page, we live there. It's a place to go to.
To visit.
Yeah, it's like our digital body, you know, we channel our thoughts into this, and it's a place we go to. We even use this terminology, like a chat room, for example, right? Or home page. It's also a space metaphor. Or you say, I'm going to go into Facebook. I don't know. We say that in Hebrew. I don't know. I'm saying that in English and it doesn't sound well because I think, but I don't know how you say, if you say it in Austria, that the metaphor is to go in to Facebook and then get out of my blog, please.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I had this in my dissertation. A couple of girls would write posts to their moms, "Mom, get out of my blog now. I don't want you reading this." It's like a room, like get out of my room, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it is public, but I need my privacy right now, like in a room at home.
So there are also feelings of privacy connected to a public web blog.
Exactly. So I think it's interesting because that it started for me when I saw this expectation of privacy. I said, how can you expect to have privacy when you're writing for the entire internet? And then I realized that I looked at the discourse and I saw that the girls on blogs, the young people, talk about the blog as a space. Grown-ups talk about the blog as a page. Mothers would tell me, all the world reads what my daughter writes and I'm the only one not entitled to? I mean, that they thought they saw it like, my daughter writes for the New York Times and I'm the only one who can't pick up the newspaper. It's a media logic of a page. And then the girls would treat it as a room or this is the hangout space where she meets her friends. And it's just weird. It's awkward if a teacher or a mom would come around and read. If we think about it as a space, it's like mom or the teacher would just follow you. You know, follow you to a corner at school and say, so what's up? You know, it's weird. So I saw this distinction and I realized later on that this distinction is valid also for understanding violence and harassment online, because many times people say, but it's just words. So he insulted you online. So what can you do about it? You know, you shouldn't pay attention. Just close the computer, go away. It's unpractical to think about it like that because it's not just words. If it happened in your Facebook page, it is also your avatar. It's like hurting your avatar, hurting your persona in a way, you know. This is slandering something that represents you. It's a problem. I mean, it's your card online in a way. And it's also a space you go to meet your friends. It's your place. It's like your living room. And just something dirty stays there, you know. So when you open a hate group against a child, for example, people from his school open a hate group. It's not just words. It's exactly like bullying him at school, but with words. But it's the same thing. A lot of people join and they look around. You know, it hurts you in the same way because you feel it's a space. After school, everybody goes to Facebook and there it happens. So when you think about it as a space, you can understand things differently, why it hurts you.
I mean, when it comes to hate groups, I can totally understand. This for me is just digital representation of something that's in the same way wrong when you do it offline or away from keyboard. But the distinction you made earlier between this is my private space and I want to keep it, yeah, not totally public, not totally open to everyone. And then at the same time, if I have these bad comments, when I have harassment on my blog, those things, I think we should separate it there because, I mean, what is the understanding of the internet in this blogosphere? Is it a total public worldwide internet or is it more like I have this page here, but I'm somehow only expecting my friends to read it? Is it more like I want to have a place to hang out with my friends even if I am not physically close to them? What is the metaphors that people really use and what are the specific concepts of public and private these people had in mind?
Well, technically and legally, the entire internet, as long as you can access it, is public. So everybody could take it out of context, everybody could do anything with it. But internet users do have these expectations that are not theoretically public. I mean, practically, who will find my little blog among 100,000 million blogs? You know, and people have ways to hide. They will not write their full name or they will write with special writing that that avoids Googling, or they would do something else in order to hide in plain sight, I call it. And I've even seen young people who want to publish something personal, even in a video, you know, confess about something, and they want mass audiences, but they don't want the people they know. So they will put it on YouTube. Who will find something on YouTube? I mean, so many hours of video, you know? And I think a grown-up, a journalist, and anyone would look at it and say, oh, this is, he put it on YouTube. I mean, he wants to be famous. He wants everybody to hear about it. Let's link it. Let's tell a story about him and give a link to him. And this link could be a form of harassment, by the way. You know, one day you wake up in the morning and your entire country is commenting because somebody gave a link on an online newspaper to the place you were trying to hide in plain sight. So it's a problem today because at least in Israel, the court of law treats the internet as totally public space, like media. And every time they have an issue about it, they think about it as television or newspaper. What would you do if? And it's so absurd that a couple of years ago we had a case about there were two dating sites that bought each other. So they became one dating site, and the Haaretz newspaper, which is a big newspaper in Israel, wrote a story about this. It was an economic story about the dating online and blah, 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 the market and everything. And then the journalist just went inside and looked for an illustration for the paper. So he browsed and he found a beautiful girl's profile. He said, yeah, let's put that in the paper. And that girl wakes up in the morning and sees the big daily paper that everyone reads, the middle spread, her picture. She took a lawyer and they sued for privacy. You know, this was a disruption of infringement of her privacy. And she didn't win because the court of law says, wait a minute, I don't get it. You published in a dating site online. It's the internet, right? So it's like publishing dating ad in a newspaper. So what do you want? So she couldn't make them understand what's the difference. And then her lawyer changed the plea to infringement of copyright because they took her words and her picture without, and then they won. So do you get it? The courts and people look at it like this. Now, how does it have to do with harassment and things? We have this phenomenon, maybe you have it too, that a lot of children in high school open hate groups to their teachers. And it's really ugly words are being said. And sometimes, you know, let's burn the school and things like that. And they put pictures of their teacher's head on, I don't know, the ass of a dog and stuff like that. The teachers who see this are really frightened. They see it, they take this word seriously as a form of threat. And we've had a couple of teachers that decided to sue for slander, and they sued the high school children for slander, which is an offense that comes from the world of media. You know, when I publish something about you that is not true in the newspaper, that is offensive, then you can sue for slander. But think about it for a minute from the perspective of kids. They think space. This is a place where they can gather and talk about the teachers. Oh, I hate this teacher. Let's burn the school, blah, blah, blah. They don't think about it as a published page, like they said something in a newspaper. And this gap is our problem right now, because we have those poor offenders. They don't see themselves as offenders. They're just talking. They're talking in a corner in school. And that corner is called the Facebook page. Yeah, whatever.
I can totally understand that. I mean, from a technical perspective, I always would keep in mind the promises that are probably made with sites when they tell you that they are a closed community and only your friends can see your stuff. Then I wouldn't be in favor of a journalist just going in there and taking media and content out and publishing pictures. And it's a classical way to get secrecy out over the breach of copyright. This is a classical discussion we also have in our country between whether the internet is a live environment or it's a media, and there is a distinction between there.
Our problem is that it's both.
at the same time, but not for the same people.
Not for the same people and not in the same context, you know? I mean, it depends on your intention. A blogger wakes up in the morning and says, well, today I want to write something for the world, whole world to know. And he does, and he even may be spreading the link. But then this whole world may roll back at the blog and arrive to something that he wrote 2 years ago, very personal, and he forgot about it, and he didn't want them to get there, and now he's pissed.
But I think these are all certain types of media literacy and awareness when it comes to personal privacy and also the structure of the internet, that it never forgets. And there, I don't think that the research itself can do much more than just describe the problems in the most accurate way to at least politicians or the society as a whole act upon it, because these are very broad issues.
I'm not sure. I think children, digital natives who grow up in this environment, lack something very profound. I don't know if you're already in this generation who lacks that, but we'll see in a minute. Lack something very profound from my generation and before. Before we had something like the internet, we grew up culturally to be bound by context. Everything we say is context specific. I'm talking to two of you in a closed room, so I'm talking one way, but you're recording me. A lot of people are going to hear this podcast, so I'm talking second way. Well, those people are all from Austria. I mean, nobody from my country or from the US might hear this, so I'm talking in a different way. But if you're broadcasting this now on CNN, I will talk a different way. I mean, we think context. We have this thing, statistical thing in our brain that does the calculation, does the math. How can we talk? How do we present ourselves in this context? And this is almost taken for granted, because this is how it is. This is how it always was. Now, imagine someone who is on Facebook from the age of 8 or has a blog from the age of 8, and he never learns the idea of context. Everything he does is theoretically and practically super public, today and forever and to everyone. Now, how can you even behave, you know? You wake up in the morning, you want to say something, and then you have to think that everyone in the world could possibly see it, and it will stay there forever, and you're 10. Would you even open your mouth? So what they do is the opposite. They don't think about it. You just do things, and then they get the repercussions. They just press on YouTube, and they start talking, oh, my father pissed me, and blah, 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 blah. And then, I don't know, after a year, his father might see it, and he might be angry. And so we're already seeing these repercussions of people talking always out of context. They don't think of context because this doesn't exist for them. They have only one context, the web, and whatever happens, happens. And I'm seeing this all the time. I'm analyzing now a case of YouTube rant that I talked about also yesterday. A student from UCLA who just wanted to rant about all the Asians studying with her, that they talk on the phone in the library, and all their families come on Friday to the dorms and cook for them. And it's, you know, she was pissed at that moment, and she wanted to say something, and she said it on YouTube, like part of a video blog. I mean, how could she think about it, that a small rant that would have been done in context between friends? Nothing would have happened, right? You can say what you want if something pisses you off. But then when she did it on YouTube, almost every Asian in America has something to say about it. And she got death threats, and all of YouTube was memed after her. And she just had to leave university and disappear. And this is just one story. So we have a new situation with this kind of publicity, that publicity is one pattern that I consider harassive. Because being public is an harassment of its own. You know, it's not only when it's out of your control, when somebody outs you, you know, says information about you online, but it also when it is your control, but you don't get the concept of it's always going to be there and everyone's going to see it. It could happen to any little post and any little video. Sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't, but you don't know. And you can't live like this. This is a power. The power of publicity was a power that only journalists had. And we're not used to the fact that each and every one of us has this huge power of publishing, getting things out to the light. Now, in Hebrew, publishing literally means getting things out to the light, you know, like light, putting a light on things. It's a huge, huge power. It could rise you up and take you down. And each and every one of us has it right now.
You just perfectly remembered me of a German theorist and blogger, Michael Simon. I'm a pro on Twitter because he also wrote about the Kontrollverlust, the loss of control in our media society. And I think it's essential for every human being to have some kind of idea about the consequences of his or her own action. And if you don't have this security that you at least somehow get an image of the consequences, then you're no longer able to behave, to argue, to do anything, because you don't know in which context you are living. And I can only qualify the problem. I have no real question about that, but it reminds me strongly about this debate, which is ongoing in Germany, and which is, I think, generally as a whole, something our society is at the moment. And was this also the conclusion of your research? Was this so the ending point or the specific definition you gave from this trolling phenomena, that it points to this discourse or this different understandings of the internet?
Actually, this is just one thing. The idea of looking at it as a space or as a page runs through a couple of other things. For example, the idea of bullying someone. You know, if you see it as just words, you won't accept this guy as a bully. Or stalking someone. How can you stalk when you may be in a different city, but somebody has got to realize that if someone reads everything you post online and just reacts on everything all the time and is always, you know, close to your neck, but online, it's a form of stalking. It's a metaphor of proximity, but you feel the same fear of someone watching you, you know, someone following you so closely that it's bothering. So you may say it's just metaphorical, but the people who live the web, and I'm not talking about people who stay inside games and things like that, but people who invest in their web personas and profiles, and a lot of their ties are being run also on the web. Like all of us are right now on Facebook. So a stalker is a real thing, you know? You feel uncomfortable with this proximity and that kind of interest in you, even if it's just a metaphor. And in this notion, I know of a few court laws and things like that in Israel that actually, despite looking at the web as a newspaper, they did allow a couple of times for husband and wife who got separated, and usually when there is a problem there, that the husband is not allowed to come close to the woman's house. So I know of a couple of people who continued stalking their ex-wives online. And the wives asked for them not to, you know, for them to have also to not have the ability to go into their website. You know, if they go and respond on their website, they're also crossing the law. And I know of two cases that this was accepted, and they were given orders not to come close to her house, not to go into her website, and things like that.
How were these things implemented?
Well, nobody can know if he doesn't go into the website, but if he comments there, if he shows, embodies himself through the words, he shows that he was there, he has something to say, it's a problem.
Okay.
So it's like coming close to you. It's interesting.
But it is a very interesting problem here, because we, especially stalking, how do you prevent stalking on the internet? Because it is inherently that you can change your identity, and you cannot just implement such legal actions for one person. You would need to install a full censorship infrastructure or total internet surveillance, like data retention is, to implement such legal orders. And there is the question, which right is more valuable? The right of the few who got insulted and to, of course, suffer from this, or the right of the whole society and the nature of the internet?
I don't think they're going technical about this. It's just that if this guy decides to pose as someone else, it will work and she will not feel harassed. But if he will talk to her as his own identity and she will feel that he's watching her and harassing her, then she would be able to show this to the police, that he doesn't come to the house, but he comes to the blog and he keeps talking to her like this. And then there will be a problem. Of course he can, you know, be someone else. But the thing, the answer is also metaphorical. It bothers you if you know. If you don't know, you feel safe. And then he can keep watching you.
Maybe we should talk in this context about the discourse you mentioned, because this is a question of power. And in this example, it's a question of gender.
Yeah, so this was just one example. But actually, there is a gender relation in this whole idea of harassment online. Because, for example, all the trolling research that was done so far, the trolls were always men. I've never read of a woman troll. Although in the Hebrew web, we have plenty of women trolls. I should probably do a research about this because it's interesting, right? There are always men trolling, and a lot of the trolling is done against women, sometimes in feminist forums. Now, it's one thing that the trolls like to pick on. And there is more men harassing women online, like maybe in life, maybe. But and also the hate speech in the Hebrew web, at least, it seems that on comments to newspapers online, most of it men are, even when they're anonymous, you know, it's men who are doing most of the hate speech. It's interesting to see when women just go into the flaming. They are there, but less, much less.
It's a question if it's really then people with a biological male gender behind those comments, or if it's more a male attitude of trolling that it's people take upon.
It's a language thing in Hebrew, at least. In English, it will probably be hard to know. Mm-hmm. But in Hebrew, you have to you have different words for different genders. So you have to disclose your gender by talking, mm-hmm. even when, you know, when you say, I know. It's not the same I know from, it's a different I know for man and a different I know for woman. So you immediately know who you're talking to. I mentioned in my book, a new book that was just out about participatory journalism. It was edited by a couple of researchers. One of them is Israeli. And they did a research about the websites of the big journals. They took major newspapers like Le Monde, Guardian, things from the US, from Israel, from Germany, big newspapers. And they interviewed the editors. How do they deal with comments and what are they trying to do? And until then, we actually thought that in Israel, the hate speech is the worst. We thought that because of cultural reasons. You know, there's forms of discourse, of direct and fierce discourse that is typical Israeli and typical Jewish. I'm going to talk about it in my talk. And everyone was sure that we would just have the worst comments in the world and everybody else is very quite polite. And then when they did this research, they found out that almost every major newspaper thinks that they have the worst comments in the world and the trolls and everything. And they had also a cultural explanation for it. The Brits, the Guardian said that the Brits are the worst. They are very critical and they're fresh and they're in your face. And the guy from Le Monde said that the French people like to fight and it's a long tradition of the way of speech and everything. And probably, I don't remember what the German guy said, but he also said that it's worse in Germany, right? So it was really interesting to see that it's probably something that is not cultural, it's universal. It has to do with the technology and with the web. And this is something I'm going to talk about today, about why it happens and what researchers were trying to say. Why is it so awful what's going on the web? Why do people are getting attacked in a way that will never happen face to face? Where does it come from? Because for years, for a decade, everybody thought it's the anonymity. I mean, when you're anonymous in psychology, you have this, when you're anonymous, you tend to be more fierce. But then look at what happens in the last couple of years. The web is not that anonymous anymore. People react, comment from their Facebook with their entire identity and friends and everything they got. And they still speak like that. What is this about? You know, or people would bully their own friends on Facebook with their identity behind them. In the last couple of years, there was more research showing how, I'm going to mention today a research talking about a flaming event that was done on a forum with people with their own names. They actually knew each other from the outside. So it's not just anonymity. It's something about the web. What I was talking before is that people try to give it cultural explanations. Oh, this is the way, this is the discourse pattern in our culture. This is how, when people meet and fight about something, this is how it looks like. But I think what I'm going to offer today is the explanation that the universal explanation that the problem is that the speech is mediated. Even if you are with your own identity, your body is behind the screen at your house and you're not seeing the face of other people. When you're looking at people face to face, something else happens. It restrains you. The way they look at you, even if you hate them, you have some form of limit. And you're just out of context. Again, the context thing. You're out of context. You're fighting with people you're not seeing. And even if they know who you are, you would just tend to be more fierce and you would go out of proportions much faster. And there would be nothing to stop you because you have no eyes, no face of a person to stop you. And I think that's the thing.
And how do you bring the context back?
That's a huge question. I want to finish the talk with this, with this idea, because now we're trying a lot of the things I have researched on the web is how people perform identity, try to write differently in order to show their tone of speech, to show their face, body language online. You know, this whole avatar thing, trying to show more aspects of their identity in order to really embody themselves online, see more of them and get the communication more clear and more rich. I mean, isn't all what we're trying to do about that? And do we succeed? I'm not sure. Because even when you see a person's photo online and all his friends and you read about him, you see his taste and what he reads, is it the equivalent of a face looking at you? Emmanuel Levinas, the French philosopher, talked about the importance of the face in an ethical situation. But when you see a person's face, something happens. It's almost mystical, you know, philosophical. He couldn't explain what is the thing that a face calls upon you. And I think that this is the thing, face to face, mediated. Whatever we do in order to give mass, give depth to our online face, it doesn't work. And I will bring up the one of the most extreme examples, I think, happened so far to this. A kid in the United States, a year or two ago, he committed suicide on YouTube. He just put the YouTube camera and he said he's going to commit suicide. And he just did it in front of everybody. He took pills and he just sat in bed. And around 1,500 people were looking at him do that. And nobody thought, you know, to call the police, to do something, to be sad about it. I mean, most of them were like, yeah, yeah, go ahead. You know, we're like, I was thinking if they would witness this face to face, who wouldn't call the police? Somebody kills himself in front of your eyes. But because even if you could see his face on YouTube, it's the most lively media we have to see video online. It's almost like being face to face, right? And it's still content. It's still entertainment. It's not a person. It's very hard for us to think there is a person out there. It's just another YouTube video doing something fun and yeah, yeah, kill yourself. Yeah, faster, faster. So if that is not enough for a person to be aware of there's a person out there, I don't know if we can. I don't know if we can find the equivalent of a human face, face to face online.
It would be just interesting to see if after you had a news item with this video embedded where it was clear that he was actually committing suicide and it was not a joke, if the people then still went on making trolling comments.
According to the news coverage, it seems that yes, you know, the horrible thing about it is that people just watched and encouraged.
I think there's probably, I mean, this mediation, there is some something in between. You cannot quite connect to the situation you're witnessing in a way you would do it in the real world. And I think that's the central piece here. It reminds me of your talk yesterday with the free hugs, where you don't
everything
just
connects.
Go on to someone on the street and say, do you want a free hug? You have a sign with free hugs. There's a mediation, something where you can hide in the back of, and the people make the decision whether they come on to you or go past you. And in this case, it's only one decision, you witnessing this. And I think it is a very tricky question, because I don't want to believe that it is a general thing. I think it is possible to don't connect over net, but at the same time, it is also possible to witness demonstrations and participate online and make this kind of connection over a mediated way. So I don't want to make it a general assumption about the internet. It's just a new possibility it opens up to act in more cruel ways than one could do in real life.
No, you're right. I was thinking about it, that part of the answer, part of the solution could be narrative, because you just go online and you see a guy that you don't know killing himself. But if you got connected to this guy somehow because you were following his blog for a while and you've identified with him and seen his problems and heard something about him, maybe you will see him as a person. So our problem is that when we go randomly about it, we just see people as content. But if on television, there's a lot of work communication scholars do about witnessing through television and how people could really feel compassion through television. You fall in love with a character, right? So maybe the answer would be that if those people online could be a character for us, because we follow them for a while, we knew them, we saw a different video in which they tell us about things, maybe this the narrative could fill in this spot and arouse this ethical situation. But when it lacks this narrative, I'm afraid that you can see that when you comment on a news story, you don't know the people you're talking to and you don't see any cues about them. So I don't see any hope there.
It's too dramatic. I'm not sure, but I wasn't sure what you meant with the voodoo effect. Is it related somehow to what we were speaking about? Because I have a feeling it is.
Oh. I call the voodoo effect a form of bullying that I mentioned before, is hurting the online persona. For example, it could be just an avatar. If I mentioned before the ability to open a hate group or a hate page to your teacher, and then you take the teacher's face and put it on a monkey, for example. So this is something you do for fun, because this is web literacy, you know, you play with design. People do this all the time. But somebody who comes and sees something like this, he feels like if you're harming the body in a way, like you're molding his image. So it's an explicit threat in a way. At least this is how teachers who weren't embedded in those practices experienced it. Know that this is like a threat on their body, like taking the head off, putting it someplace else as a form of threat. I thought that it works like voodoo. Know that you say in voodoo, you take something and you say, this represents you. This doll represents you. And now I'm going to punch this doll and then you're going to feel it hurt. So I think we have this kind of connection with our avatars, with our representations, with the persona that we nurture online. And I think it's worse when it's not just, oh, this doll represents you. It's not just a statement. This thing that represents us online, our Facebook profile, our pictures, our image, like people are Googling us. This is our image. This is our online identity, the sum of it. This, we are invested in it. We control it. And when you control something, you're much more identified with it, like your character, your avatar in a game, let's say World of Warcraft or Second Life. You live through it, so you control it, so you identify with it. And let's say somebody just comes and shoots it. You can almost feel the pain of this, you know what I mean? So this is the voodoo effect, and I think that hurting a character or trashing your image online, or taking your head and putting it on a naked model and saying something towards it, you actually feel like voodoo was done to you, like somebody is harming your persona and and it's a form of harassment that didn't exist before. You know, it's just, it's not like words are not just words. Molding designs is not just molding designs. It means something. It's scary. Imagine you would see a picture of you on the ass of a dog and people would say, "We hate Daniel." It's creepy. So it's on that little mystical level, like voodoo, mm-hmm. that you don't believe in it, but you would never go under a letter. So I think it hurts you in that spot.
And the people doing this know that they can hurt the people doing this.
That's the sad part. I think they don't know, especially youth. They don't know. This is what they do. They grow up playing with Photoshop. And this is, for them, that's speech. That's the way to express themselves. It's perfectly normal that kids hate their teachers and they talk about it. But today, talking is different. Today, talking is making a video, is taking the teacher's head and putting it on a monkey. That's the way to talk. This is the new literacy kind of talk online. They're not aware of it being hurtful.
But is it then not also covered by free speech? And something like the First Amendment. I mean,
yeah.
It is an expression of opinion. It's a cultural, it's a mediated, performative way of saying something.
No, I know what you mean. And it's an interesting question because I don't think we're even close to anybody taking it away. Not only because it's a form of expression, it's because everybody thinks it's just expression. It's just a form of expression. The problem is, you know, all the things I'm talking about are not even in the realm of law. It's ethics. And we have to understand the repercussions for both sides. But I know it's perfectly normal, but I do have to tell you that there is one law professor in Israel that is actually trying to form the idea of, like, we have a right of privacy. We should have a right or certain rights about our online identity. I mean, if it gets stolen, if somebody trashes our identity, if somebody hurts our online resources, if somebody makes it that the first thing they look on Google and put our name on Google and the first thing they see is something hateful, it's wrong. And we have a right to our online image and things like that. So there is something cooking about this, but I think it will take a decade to try to convince someone that this is an actual resource and online damage is actual damage.
I don't think it will take a decade to come to political decisions on that. When the damage is done to famous people or big corporations or politicians, then I think they will be quite fast to implement laws from people preventing that. At least they will try it over the already possible ways of infringement. And yeah, again,
but look at the way they're fighting so far. They're fighting through only the norms that they know. Copyright, because it's like media. I don't know, a site. They don't see a website as a space. It's not, I caught this place first. It is my copyright. This is my copy sign. So I'm entitled to this place. So as long as the law would look at it as media, it will be very easy to fight it through media ways. I mean, people are being silenced with copyright because they used in order to speech, in order to express themselves, they used a bit of a song. And then that's the way to silence them, copyright. This is a problem. But this is not the same problem when you take non-celebrity photo and you do something with it, or when you write, okay, I'll present something more interesting in this one. It's a true story. Girl wrote on her blog very bad things about her teacher. And she could do it on her blog because she's talking to her friend and she's telling what the teacher has done, and it's ugly. This teacher is not a big web mouse, so there's not much about her in Google. But then when you Google her, this is the first thing you see. First or second, you see this about her. Now, this teacher is very young. She came to me and she said, "Listen, I don't know what to do. I mean, I'm dating guys and they Google me and this is what they find. And if I want to go work in a different place and they Google me, this is what they find. So can I go to this girl and tell her to take it out? I mean, what rights do I have about, I don't have rights about her blog and it's her private space, but her private space is at the same time my Google image. Whose identity is it? Whose space is it? They collide, you see?
But it's like a person that comes into being on a planet, never says anything at all except some random third character speaking about her. She has all possibilities and rights to also post in her own name, make a Twitter account, write something, at least write the CV or something, you know. She has this right. She could also go to the person and just have a normal conversation and trying to get her understand. But this call for legal action in these cases, from my understanding, is very critical, because it makes the net in its structure and the free speech that comes with it, it makes it look like some of the biggest problems and birth failures, as some German politicians refer to the internet.
Well, let me ask you, Thomas, you are now also treating the web as a page, and you're talking about it in the terms of speech. But what if it is a space? In a space, you would agree that someone who hurts someone else has to go back home and close the door. She cannot hurt her in a public space. Now, if you start looking at it as space, it's a different question. It's how people behave. The speech is also behavior. It's not just speech. So when it has the repercussion of behavior, you have to think about it differently a bit.
But I would see a space anonymity with public internet thing, where everyone can read it. If we're speaking about something like, not even Facebook, something really private, a private chat room, there I can totally let myself go. Or if I take another identity, then we could talk about it. But now people start using the internet in a way where all those people who started 10 years ago are for a good reason frustrated, because the power of this new technology as an uncensored medium for all of the world is, in my opinion, much more important than the coziness of a family space or a friend's place to meet, where you have to implement very dangerous technologies just to fulfill some functions that should be dealt with on a sociological level. You know, we have this saying, you cannot solve sociological problems with technique.
And yeah, you're right. And maybe the solving would be just norms. Like, you learn the norms of a new place you go to. This is how you tip here. This is how you talk here. So this is what you do on the web. You don't do that, and you try not to do that, because this is how people experience it. Maybe it will be just net etiquette.
And I would really like to get some information on you, on something you mentioned yesterday in the other talk. And that was the idea of using memes. I'll give a short introduction. Richard Dawkins came up with this word. He is a biologist and strongly in favor of evolution and Darwin. And he used memes as an analogy of genes and put it in a way that memes are ideas that live in our brains. The analogy is that you have variation and selection, those two basic principles of the evolution, and apply them to human thought. And in this sense, our brains and our awareness are the habitats of these thoughts. And these thoughts are either more or worse appropriate to our brains, and therefore can survive or adapt or mix. That's a basic thing. And he wrote this book in the 70s, and not much research came after it, except some popular science, which was quite creepy. And I also looked at it and thought it is a very interesting concept and one should do something with it. And it's also widely used as a popular phrase when it comes to internet memes.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your research about, or where would you see this concept usable?
I noticed memes as, first of all, as literacy.
Mm-hmm.
And I noticed that this is a way to participate online. I mean, if we talked before about comments in words, the way to comment on a video is to meme it, to try to remix it, or to try to perform something similar but a bit different, like parody. And this is part of the web's new literacy. And it looked interesting to me at the beginning, but it was just something fun. It took me a while to see that people are actually talking and developing conversations through this. And I was thinking, wow, speech is not simple anymore. People just don't tell to each other, hey, that was wrong, you're racist. They do a video that we're supposed to interpret this. You know, they don't even say it. So it was interesting to see how speech is becoming more layered, and we actually speak today on the web through humor and parody and irony and all satire and all of those things that used to be artist territory. So I was interested in that angle. And I'm also interested now in seeing how this is taken to the next level in the last 2 years. There are a lot of memes, especially from the genre of flash mobs, and some lip dubs that's starting here and there, that are actually not just for fun or not to sell something even. And they're being used as a form of social action and totally replacing a demonstration. So I thought it was really interesting to see how this kind of speech, taking it as a social action, is achieving a lot of attention, and even for topics that would be considered non-coverage. You know, if you do a demonstration about workers' rights in a small hotel, who would know about it? Who would care about it? Who would even read a blog post about it? And if you do a flash mob, then a lot of people will see it, and maybe there will be more flash mobs mimicking it in different or similar contexts. And you could just get attention to a message you want through this form of literacy. I thought it was interesting to do something with it.
I found it still fascinating. And you mentioned yesterday that you will go in the direction of discourse analysis with this. Do you have already some kind of empirical framework how you want to do that? Because I find this also...
Yeah, to tell you the truth, it's very odd, and I know I need to be methodic about it, so that's why I'm going to postdoc. In a month and a half, I'm going to be at Indiana University in Bloomington. I'm going to work with Professor Suzanne Herring, which is one of the leading scholars on discourse language online, and... She has very methodic methods of analyzing web content as discourse, from videos to websites to everything. So I'm hoping to work with her and learn there to be more methodic about it, because I'm bringing more qualitative thought to it. I'm thinking of just analyzing the through the genres of parody, irony, trying to see, to interpret what are they actually saying in this seamlessly fun meme. And I want to analyze a case, the case I talked about before about the Asians and the library. I want to analyze it as a conversation, a meme that is actually a conversation. And then I could see those patterns as discourse, as a form of discourse. What are they actually saying through parody, satire, pastiche, and things like that? This is the direction I was going to, but this is highly qualitative. This is almost going to literature. So let's see what Suzanne says about it.
Yeah, I'm very interested in your findings, because if you can develop some kind of a capable framework on decrypting this chain of internet memes, it would maybe give us a bigger understanding of many internet phenomena.
That's what I plan to.
But you're not taking upon this original meme thought from Richard Dawkins, because it was one thing many people are quoting, but no one actually does anything about it, because it's not explaining anything intrinsically in it. It is a good word, but it's like early anthropology in the times where we thought of original thoughts. They just travel from culture to culture, and it just didn't turn out to work like that. There are no original thoughts that adapt, and there is some godlike fire in them that develops. And so memetics is very interesting, but still, if someone from our listeners has research about it, I'm still searching for it. Oh, we still have some minutes left, I think.
I can answer you then.
Please.
I think maybe the theory has loose ends, because you're not sure where a meme begins and comes from, if it works, how it works, and where it goes and how it dies. But I do like the middle. I think the middle is something that we noticed before, that things do travel, they spread, and they change as they spread, because everybody performs it a bit differently. And then the thing changes, is some things survive, some things are forgotten, some things survive over time, but are being changed. So we know that from various disciplines, and I think this mimetic behavior is something we can count on and we can look at and we can take something. But the what's radical in Dawkins' thought is that he thought that we actually have no identity.
Yeah.
That the memes are the intelligence. I mean, we channel those memes and we think this is us, but we're just bits of a mashup, a remix of broken memes or something like that. I think it's very radical, but it's not so different, just a different language than saying what the postmodernists say, right? That we actually don't have an essence. I don't know. I mean, for me, it's not so strange.
Oh, I mean, I see myself as a constructivist, and that's a similar thought in a way.
Mm-hmm.
But still, when you divide this idea of traveling thoughts away from it, which you also have in the Bible, for example, the Shibboleth, this in-group knowledge that you are part of us and it travels over the whole group, but it's kind of secret and not spread outwards of it. That's definitely a value he added to the theory. But on the other hand, I still can't, I don't feel comfortable with the idea of cultural units. And the idea that this thing cannot be invented twice at the same time. That's just wrong in my eyes.
Well, I think they could be invented at the same time. That's because it probably, he says that it probably was invented even before. We don't know what the source of a meme is, but it can appear in two places at the same time because it doesn't belong to any of those people. It just channels through them. So it's actually a good explanation for this. Although it sounds quite mystical. Where does this meme come from? And mystical is not Dawkins. So I don't know. It's an interesting thing, but I think the web has a special role here. Because as I said yesterday, every meme or every cultural artifact or story, let's say story, not to spite you, every story that would travel in oral days, it would necessarily change on the way. Because every person who tells the story changed it, forgets it, something happens to it. So those stories and those transmissions always changed. And the web today, we have a perfect technology, not like us flawed humans who change things when we perform them. We have a perfect technology that we can just forward and share the initial message, an identical copy of it, and it does not change. I think it's dangerous.
Yeah, it's not enough.
No, it's something doing something viral. I mean, over space, well, it's nothing. No. But what if something gets viral over time? You have the original all the time. You can't alter it. You can't make it, you know, relevant to your times. Yeah. It's just you're stuck with it. It's very, very dangerous. I think our flaw is a strength that we change things.
Yeah, and therefore we develop the desire to remix. Because we want change. We want a different reinterpretation of this piece of art or text or whatever.
So actually, memeing is a good answer to viral. Viral is dangerous. Memeing something that changes it keeps it alive.
That's a perfect end statement for a podcast. And because your talk in the other building is starting shortly.
Oh, we have to go.
It's good then. Yeah. I'm very, very happy with this interview, and I hope our listeners also enjoyed it. And yeah, Kamal Weismann, it's a big pleasure to have you here in Vienna. And will there be a recording of your talk?
I hope so. I brought a video camera with me. I even hope there will be video.
Mm. Where can one find you on the internet?
You can find me on Twitter. It's Carmelva, Carmelva.
Okay, great. Yeah, then, Daniel, thank you for inviting me.
Oh, wait, and I have a blog.
Ah,
absolutecarmel.com.
Perfect. And we'll also put all those in the link list. Yeah, it was a big pleasure to be here, and yeah, hopefully hear you all soon.